homosexual males from New York, San Francisco, and L.A. It's a very, very particular virus. I don't buy that. If you tell me it's someone from Haiti brought it over here, I said, one, it's interesting. We never heard of it being in Haitians until we had the Haitians put in concentration camps in Florida, and then suddenly we were able to backtrack and find it in Haiti. Two, the average Haitian and the above and below average Haitian who comes to the United States moves into a black Haitian community, which intermingles more with the routine black community, which has some association with the white community, and will finally find its way to the white gay community. Haitians do not have a strong association with white male homosexuals. So again, if it was brought to here by a Haitian, how does he get from the boat to the white gay male community in L.A., San Francisco, and New York without and bypassing the Haitian community and the black community, particularly in L.A., where there is, you know, we've had no cases. That just makes no sense. You have a disease that is predominantly in Americans. The other cities, Chicago, New York, Chicago, Washington, Philadelphia, Baltimore, New Orleans, with very large gay populations, larger in number than San Francisco, but are not at all afflicted with the number of cases. So it is not just numbers of homosexuals. It is not just promiscuity. What is unique about those three cities is the fact they have a very structured gay community, more than any other city. And I think that's interesting. I think we need to be asking, is there an association with that fact that the three cities that we have rampant cases, a really high number of cases and rate, are the three cities that have, if you could rate it, a more structured gay community. Washington, D.C. has a very, very large gay community, but it's a very, very integrated gay community. So is Chicago, and so is New Orleans. But those three cities have very identifiable gay communities. Is that by accident? Is that also coincidental? I mean, there's too many coincidences here for me to accept. And to me, it points to this being a disease that is an American disease. Now, where it came from, one can speculate and go from one extreme to the other, but I personally think it is something that was created in some kind of laboratory here.
I think it's interesting that researchers are spending a lot of time trying to figure out where it came from, what other country, and not that much money is being spent on research. Some people are speculating on the idea that that why is it certain gay populations, I mean, you just mentioned that it's three urban centers that seem to be the ones that are getting it, and the news media is playing up the fact of lifestyle, but there's a lot of the other reasons. When you mentioned earlier the unification of these particular gay communities, how do you think that that could be used in some way, both to fight the disease and for somehow the disease to be brought in?
Well, I think, I hope I can speak freely without offending someone, without trying to catch my word and maybe not be totally understood. I think what is unique about white homosexual males, and I will separate them from black homosexual males particularly, is that they have tried to proclaim themselves as an ethnic group. You have now a new ethnic group with no international ties. It is an American ethnic group. You really can't say it about black homosexuals because black homosexuals have never been in the closet to come out of. They've been out of the closet. You can go to any black church in any major city and you will find people who everyone knows is gay, who's functioning, who has a very established, responsible role in churches and other organizations too. This is, again, to me, a white male homosexual phenomenon. And the best way I can explain it is to give an example. If I were to have, or you were to give me a virus that had an effect on skin color, and we say this virus will make black people sterile, but it may turn white people green, we need to test it to see we've seen it in rats, we've seen it in monkeys, let's see if it would do what we think it would do in black people. Well, I know there are certain places I can go in the black community where the people, basically, total association, total lifestyle of black people. I wouldn't go to Second Baptist Church here in L.A. I wouldn't go to Concord Baptist Church in New York. I don't know any of the names of the major churches in San Francisco, but my point, I wouldn't go to a place that had a very middle-class type a black audience, because those people would have contact the next day with whites, so you would have an overflow into the white community right away. I do know where there are clubs. I do know where there are storefront churches. I do know where there are places I go to in the black community, where the people, first, second, third, and go probably four generations, their contacts are all black. I don't know that about the gay community. I think you have that same counterpart, though, in New York, San Francisco, and L.A. You don't have it as much in Washington, Chicago, and other cities, but you have the numbers. So somebody else may know what places they can go that you could do the same thing. And I think it's interesting that in some of the early cases of the disease, you had a lot of interesting stories, and particularly the one in San Francisco where there were nine people, all had been at one bar and a table. One physician in San Francisco knew 20 of the first 45 cases. That's atypical. There's no one physician in any city, even if he can proclaim himself to be a gay doctor or just serve in the gay community, would know that just by accident. That's strange. There have been too many sort of strange things happen with this disease. And one still can't account for the fact that now, in 1984, we're going into 85, this disease started in 79, you still are seeing the same percentages stay in the same three cities. No other disease does that. Hepatitis didn't do that. Amoebasis didn't do that. San Francisco is probably the gay capital of the U.S. in terms of somebody in Des Moines, Iowa, or Little Rock, fantasizing where to go. And then go to San Francisco or New York or L.A. Still, in a lot of those cases, if you've had those cities, have been people who've come to San Francisco or who went to Los Angeles or New York and got infected and came back. But you haven't had it set up that much there and started spreading. That's interesting. You don't have in many cities with reasonable and sizable gay communities an ongoing epidemic like you have in San Francisco, which is now really out of hand.
That's interesting, because I think the doctors around here are talking about AIDS as being a social phenomenon versus a disease phenomena. When you talk about...
Well, you know, when you say social, there's the only thing you can... Homosexuals today are not doing anything they weren't doing in the times of Rome. The human body hasn't changed. There is still the same anatomy. Nothing is new. There are maybe one or two new... The most new things are basically the cosmetics one uses is new. That's not... been before, but certainly the sex acts aren't new. Men do one particular sex act that is strictly a male act that you don't find women and women doing or men and women doing. And from my reading, I haven't heard of it being that long. So I don't know, that's the only, if I would say, new sex act that involves using the fist. But other than that, certainly sex acts per se is nothing new. We've been doing it all along. So it can't just be the sex act. It can be promiscuity. You've had promiscuous heterosexuals, homosexuals for years. That's nothing new. In San Francisco and in Little Rock and in Oklahoma City, you've had promiscuity for years in terms of one individual being promiscuous, in terms of a lot of individuals being promiscuous. Gay bathhouses are not new. You've had them for years. At least 20 years, you've had bathhouses. So that's nothing new. So if you're going to say this disease, I've had 56 cases, most of whom, in terms of their sexual contact, you really can plot it being 2 to 6 months. I differ with some saying this is the 4 year. I don't believe that. Most of the patients I've had, their contact, you could really tell, was relatively 2 to 4 month incubation period. If that is the case, this is something new. Now, when Lassa fever, if you remember, in 72, 73, became known in Africa, before the first case got out, we knew about it. A quarantine station and all of our major ports were on alert. You checked everyone. Smallpox, if someone got a fever on a plane from any country that had smallpox, you knew about it. We knew how many cases of smallpox were in the deepest part of Ethiopia, Somalia, and India. We've known about it all the time. Marburg virus, we knew. We caught it. Now, I'm expected to believe that this virus, which is so much deadlier, which might not wipes you out, an American who is among the healthiest persons in this world, I'm now expected to believe it has been in existence in Haiti, which is the poorest country in this hemisphere, where the average person is malnourished already, where the average person's immune system is already compromised. If AIDS began in Haiti, Haiti wouldn't have any people. And if AIDS began in Haiti, why don't we see it on the Dominican Republic, which is the same island? It's just, you know, it's a mountain that separates two countries. It makes no sense.
We're speaking with Dr. Wilbert Jordan, and he's the director of graduate medical education at Martin Luther King Hospital in L.A., and he's the ex-public health chief for the southern area of L.A. County. He's had training in infectious diseases. We're almost running out of time, Dr. Jordan, and it seems to me that you're building up to say something. I mean, from what you're saying, it seems to me that there's some type of testing going on. Maybe I'm at liberty to say that, but What do you think, actually, why are these certain populations getting it? And I wish we had more time to talk, and in the future we can do a longer interview.
Well, I don't think I want to say why. I think we need to ask ourselves why, and look at it. Pick up any book and look at any other disease, and you would see that it is extremely difficult for any other disease, hepatitis B, which we theorize being transmitted the same way, has not stayed strictly in the gay male community in three cities. All I am really suggesting is that we start asking ourselves, one, why do we continue to look outside of these shores for the cause of it, or for the origin of this disease, and why does it tend to stay in three metropolitan areas when there are many other cities in this country that have very large gay populations? This is not the first time we've had some kind of, quote, germ warfare. I mean, San Francisco subways were sprayed with serratia bacteria, as you know. We did treat black soldiers with syphilis and then treat them. We did give black soldiers syphilis and then treat them. There have been other kinds of experiments. And whether this is one of them, I don't know. But I think one has to look at something from these shores, or at least entertain that idea to see if, in fact, it is not that, rather than trying to assume it comes from an underdeveloped country, where if you've seen patients with the disease, you see it's devastating. If this disease began in any underdeveloped country, there is no way in this world it could have began there and us not know about it before it got here. I mean, it's this of all diseases, this. We even knew about super gonorrhea in the Philippines, and it did not kill anyone. How in the world could you have a disease like this that has, at this point, a 50% mortality in 2 years, and hopefully, unless we can find some treatment, those other persons who have the disease have a 2-year life expectancy. This is the most deadly disease we've had created that we've known about in our lifetime. How could you possibly have had it in an underdeveloped country where the average person is malnourished, already susceptible, and not see any cases until you've had over 500 in the United States? And then you go back retroactively and found it in Zaire. That makes no sense.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time and all the information that you gave to the KPFA listening audience. I would like to do a longer interview with you at some other time. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and again, that was Dr. Wilbert Jordan being interviewed on December 16th, 1984 by Rena Cowan on KPFA. And pretty clearly, I think, well, as a matter of fact, directly at one point, Dr. Jordan said that he felt, quite frankly, that we had to look to the labs of America as the source point for the AIDS virus. Again, commenting very much on some of the things that we were talking about the strange pattern of the disease, that it would pick out specific groups, and in this case, even specific gay communities, and would in fact mutate and change in such a way. And his suggestion, taking his suggestion and combining it with some of the things we've heard about earlier, it might lead to some speculation that perhaps what we have then is a disease that existed in some form already, as we've seen perhaps as a heterosexual disease in Zaire, and was tested there in some ways as the mutation was performed, the genetic recombination or something, and then perhaps was released in the United States. Again, questions are open, but certainly the questions need to be asked.
Okay, now one of the reasons that AIDS is such a very, very important subject to study, and in particular the possibility that it may have been manufactured by our own government and is being deliberately used for whatever reason, is that in order to combat, aside from the basic issue of the fact that many, many people are being killed and sickened by this disease, In order to prevent the spread of AIDS, a number of far right-wing sources, various reactionary elements, have proposed a number of very draconian measures in the recently much-publicized primary elections that the LaRouche organization won. They began talking, the LaRouches, that is, centered their campaign in considerable measure on confining people who are potentially at risk for AIDS. I guess they're proposing quarantining AIDS patients. The religious right, the Jerry Falwells, the Moral Majority, and so forth, have been very, very active in proposing anti-gay legislation and suggesting basically that AIDS is the visitation of the Lord on sinners and sodomizers and fornicators and so forth. Perhaps the point is that AIDS is being used as a major, major political tool by the far right in this country, and perhaps the most dramatic and potentially alarming use of AIDS by the far right is potential use of AIDS by the far right was covered in the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle on February 9th of 1986. This is an article headlined "Extreme Proposal by AIDS Researchers." It's by David L. Kirp, and it's a KIRP, and it's a special to the Examiner. It reads as follows: "The military is seriously considering spending $12.5 million. To fund a study aimed at proving AIDS is casually transmitted and at devising methods to control the disease that appear to be constitutionally questionable. The proposal, which contradicts established scientific data on AIDS, contemplates forbidding association between servicemen and members of high-risk groups and quarantining those who have been exposed to AIDS." Now, it doesn't say when exposed to AIDS, whether that means basically someone who tests positive for antibodies to the HTLV-3 or whether someone has actually contracted the disease, because a lot of people, as pointed out, have antibodies to the HTLV-3 virus and do not have AIDS. Continuing with the article, "Extreme public health measures," unquote, "may be necessary," says the proposal by San Francisco-based scientists seeking funding for the study. "Some of these measures would be in direct conflict with the Constitution," unquote, the researchers concede. The drastic measures are not only spelled out in the proposal sent to the military, but a memo circulated among those working on the project mentions, quote, "mandatory and overt identification of AIDS victims," unquote, however loathsome a Star of David concept, unquote. The reference is to the symbol Nazis used to publicly identify Jews. Initiators of the proposal are two scientific research organizations with a long history of work for the military. One has conducted biological and chemical warfare research. They are backed by a stellar list of collaborators, including scholars of the Hoover Institution of Stanford University, a conservative think tank that lists President Reagan as an honorary fellow, and SRI International of Menlo Park. That's Stanford Research, by the way, of Menlo Park. The proposal's premise runs counter to overwhelming scientific opinion on acquired immune deficiency syndrome by asserting that the fatal disease will be proven communicable by touch or even by close proximity to people with AIDS. It suggests the disease will be proven transmissible through tears, saliva, feces, urine, or sweat, and that infection can follow a sneeze or cough, a mosquito bite, or something as simple as touching a doorknob or toilet handle used by someone with the disease. I would interrupt here that in much of the other literature it is pointed out that although mosquitoes communicate malaria in places like Africa, there's no indication that insects can communicate this disease. Continuing with the article, it projects a catastrophic epidemic within a decade, infection of 10% of the population of the United States and 68.2% of the military. A copy of the proposal marked confidential by its authors was obtained by the Examiner. It says, "Consistent with the need to be conservative in avoiding undue alarm until all the facts are in, the prevalence of published and expressed medical opinion is that AIDS infection cannot occur through casual transmission of the virus. However, the non-medical public and an increasing number of medical scientists are fearful that AIDS may be spread through various forms of casual contact. Because it is a slow virus and the evidence is that the incubation period is dosage-related, illness may not become manifest until many years after casual infection occurs. It can therefore be argued that AIDS cases resulting from low-dosage casual contact infection are not yet appearing on a widespread basis, but that many cases could surface in the years ahead," unquote. Both the premise and research agenda of the proposal, which has passed an initial screening by the Army's Medical Research and Development Command at Fort Detrick, Maryland, drew strong criticism from public health officials, leading medical researchers, and politicians with expertise on AIDS. Reading that last sentence again. Both the premise and social and research agenda of the proposal, which has passed an initial screening by the U.S. Army's Medical Research and Development Command at Fort Detrick, Maryland. Of course, we know that that is now the National Cancer Institute, which discovered, quote-unquote, the AIDS virus, drew strong criticism from public health officials, leading medical researchers, and politicians with expertise on AIDS. Skipping down in the article, the initiators of the proposal are AIMS, Advanced Investigation of Medical Science Group, and the Institute for Cancer Research, both housed at the Pacific Presbyterian Medical Center. Both have done previous research for the military previously. Since 1962, the AIMS group has done classified work on biological and chemical warfare. Two of the senior Hoover Institution scholars who will do economic and political analyses for the study are Rita Ricardo Campbell, who was a leading contender to succeed Margaret Heckler as Secretary of Health and Human Services last year, and Richard Starr, a specialist on the Soviet Union, who headed America's delegation to the Mutual and Balanced Force Reduction talks between 1981 and 1983. Glenn Campbell, director of the Hoover Institution and Ricardo Campbell's husband, denied that the institution is formally involved with the project. So there are a couple of things to contemplate here. Well, there are a lot of things to contemplate here in connection with this article. Obviously, the fact that the military here, and this is primarily a military or military-associated group of people here, and also, incidentally, people very close to the Reagan administration, the links between the Hoover Institute and the Reagan administration are very close and of long standing, that basically this group is saying, and whether they know something we don't or whether it's being done for psychological reasons, that AIDS may very well be casually transmitted, and they're proposing essentially tossing the Constitution down the drain in order to deal with this. Now, Nip is going to embellish on this here in just a second. One of the things to take note of here, of course, aside from the Fort Detrick connection here, which is front and center with regard to AIDS, it's worth noting that the Reagan administration has been very, very quick to propose restrictions in our civil liberties, many of them obviously unconstitutional, and it's worth thinking about the possibility that if, and I say if, AIDS has been deliberately spread by our government, that whether perhaps a restriction of the Constitution was one of the things they had in mind as part of this program. Again, the Hoover Institute, Army's Medical Research and Development Command at Fort Detrick, these two groups, the Pacific Presbyterian Medical Center and AIMS, both involved with chemical and biological warfare research from the Army, that and the Hoover Institute, very close to Ronald Reagan, proposing basically chucking the Constitution in order to deal with AIDS.
Yeah, exactly. The point that I wanted to make, Dave, is basically made, but let me embellish it, as he said, a little bit. What we have here is a direct circuit of cause and effect, or apparently a direct circuit of cause and effect, directly through the military, from one end to the other. We talked earlier, of course, about all the biological warfare being under the military. What we have in this case is a plan that has been essentially put forward by military bacteriological warfare contractors, has been approved by the preliminarily approved by the military's Bacteriological and Chemical Warfare Research Center, which is housed in the same building with the National Cancer Institute, which presumably has the cutting edge of medical information on hand, which at this point suggests that everything that these people are saying is incorrect. So not only do we have these military people, but then we have the plan proposed by a couple of Hoover fellows, one of whom is an expert in Soviet affairs, which one has to wonder what this man is doing.
And also, who was involved with the arms talks. I mean, he was one of our delegates to strategic arms limitation talks.
Indeed. So what we have here is a very strange cycle coming, emanating and returning directly to the military. And one has to ask, in this case, if we have, supposedly, as we're being constantly told, the best scientists in the country working on this, and things of this nature, then really, basically, from the most absolute fundamental point of view, what is the military doing involved with AIDS and the prevention of the spread of AIDS and the quarantining of AIDS victims without any kind of congressional or even executive initiative, at least overt executive initiative whatsoever? It is very bizarre and very fishy.
And again, consider that this one fellow is Richard Starr is not only an expert on the Soviet Union, but one of our representatives to strategic arms talks. What intersection could there be between AIDS and strategic arms? Something we should think about, perhaps.
Yes, right. And let's think about, again, as they said, self-admittedly, they said, the Star of David concept. And again, remember that not only in Germany were the Jews forced to go on with yellow stars of David's pinned to their clothes, but the gays wore pink triangles and were separated out in many of them, hundreds of thousands of gays, in fact. fact, died alongside the Jews and the Slovaks and the Slavs, and the Gypsies and other groups and intellectuals and communists in the extermination camp. So certain people have had the gays on their agenda for some time.
And it's worth noting that the idea of getting rid of various groups who were in the way was made a lot easier, a lot more palatable for the German public, those who were aware of it, by the fact that gays, who were a traditionally out group, an outcast group, were the first to go. It made it much easier to accept the later exterminations on the part of the Nazis. It's a tactic the Nazis refer to as salami tactic, literally just like slicing a sausage. You know, you take off a little bit at a time, and you end up, before you know it, the whole thing is gone. And that is something to think about. We're going to sum up very briefly the line of development from the military that we've looked at this evening. We began by taking a look at the development of the U.S. chemical and biological warfare program, beginning with the importation of Unit 731 from Japan, the most advanced biological warfare unit of its time, which had experimented on American and other allied POWs. No matter, we brought them right into Fort Detrick, the top Army Chemical and Biological Warfare Research Center, and that unfortunate tradition was continued at Fort Detrick. We looked at a long history of experimentation of sometimes harmless and sometimes not so harmless biological reagents on unwitting segments of the civilian population. We also took a look, in particular, at attempts to deal with one or another ethnic or cultural or sexual group. Experiments aimed at affecting just black people or people with a particular blood type. In other words, ethnic or culturally specific diseases. After that, we also took a look at a proposal in 1969 from a House Appropriations Subcommittee that basically, due to the advances in recombinant DNA, it should be possible to make a new disease which would confound the human immune system. And whether refractory means to be resistant to or to break down is, food for thought and grounds for further research. We then noted that Fort Detrick was turned over ostensibly to the civilian population, and specifically to the National Cancer Institute, although we found out that the National Cancer Institute facility at Fort Detrick basically was maintained by Litton Bionetics, a major, major defense contractor with links to the Nixon administration as well as to the Hughes organization. We've also found out that the National Cancer Institute was the organization which discovered, quote-unquote, the AIDS virus. We found out that the Fort Detrick base was at least partially maintained by the military, and that the military there has been working on recombinant DNA in combination with the National Institutes of Health, of which the National Cancer Institute is one, as well as the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control. We then took a look at a British expert's opinion that, in fact, the AIDS virus is a genetically engineered sheep virus, the Vizsna virus, and we took a look at an article which pointed out great similarities in the behavior of the HTLV-3 and the sheep Vizsna virus. We took a look also at information concerning the possibility of cross-vectoring, and it was a disease produced by the intersection of several viruses, and one of those that came under discussion was the African swine fever virus, which agricultural officials were attempting to suppress, the results of which agricultural officials were attempting to suppress due to national security reasons. Okay, we then took a look at the fact that Cuba experienced an outbreak of swine fever, and this took place at about the same time as AIDS was being introduced into the Caribbean. We took a look then at AIDS in the Third World. Specifically, we took a look at the fact that AIDS is most prevalent in Haiti, the United States, and Grenada. And, of course, Grenada and Haiti, U.S.-sponsored dictatorships in the Caribbean. In Africa, the highest incidence of AIDS is in Zaire, which just happens to be run by Mobutu Sese Seko, again, a CIA-sponsored dictator in Africa. We also took a look at the fact that the CIA's department, the CIA's biological warfare reagents are also stored at Fort Detrick, which eventually became the National Cancer Institute's laboratory for molecular oncology. And we've taken a look at, finally, the assertion by Dr. Wilbur Jordan of Martin Luther King Hospital that basically AIDS, from an epidemiological standpoint, makes no sense, that it is much more probably a disease manufactured, at least in his opinion, a disease manufactured in the United States and being tested on segments of our own and other nations' population. And finally, of course, we took a look at a proposal by not only the Army's command at Fort Detrick, their biological warfare command at Fort Detrick, but the Hoover Institute, a mainstay of Reagan's support and ideology, and other elements connected with biological warfare research to basically drive a bulldozer through the Constitution in order to deal with this disease, a disease, as we've seen, which may very well have been manufactured by the very people who proposed to man the bulldozer.
Indeed, and that about wraps up what we wanted to talk about tonight. As we spoke about at the beginning of the hour, largely a speculative series, although again, as we said, that this is the kind of speculation that needs to be done, because as Dr. Wilbert Jordan mentioned, and as we have been talking about all night, there are some very strange things unanswered, and Dr. Jordan was not even, of course, taking into account the stuff that we have been detailing fairly exhaustively tonight, which is the relationship between these various groups orbiting around the search or the quest for the cure for AIDS and the National Security Establishment. And it is stuff that needs to be talked about. Again, perhaps there are many things that we have put forward tonight as being true that are not true. We do not know. However, people who are afraid to ask questions sometimes get their answers by surprise. And if you don't want to do so, we would advise you to get your head up out of the sand with us and at least have a look around. And that is what we've been trying to do.
Obviously, again, as Nip said, this is a speculative program. We're presenting, as we always do with our Radio Free America shows, the documentation upon which our speculation is based. Usually these are more or less straight historical regurgitation. In this case, we're looking ahead a little bit and speculating, but again, with all of the various tributaries running from the AIDS investigation to the U.S. National Security Establishment, it's a question which has to be asked under the circumstances. And again, for those people who might still be skeptical, given the seriousness of this disease and given the connections, albeit circumstantial, to the National Security Establishment, it's something that needs to be asked. And if people think that it's perhaps a little excessive or off the wall, well, again, just consider what the military was looking forward to in 1969. Again, reading from A Higher Form of Killing by by Paxman and Harris. Again, quoting from that House Appropriations Subcommittee, within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new, infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. And then the authors go on to comment, the possibility that such a super germ may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside. And again, don't cast that aside too readily, because as they say on the street, what goes around comes around.
That's right. This is Nip Tuck. Dave Emery and myself will be back next month with an expanded series of archive broadcasts on the Mediterranean merry-go-round. Coming up is Bob Lindsay. He will be here till late in the evening playing music for you, or late in the morning, I guess, at this point, playing music for you. And we will join you next time. Thanks for being with us. And remember, if you stand up, it's harder for them to keep their foot on your neck. We'll see you soon. You've been listening to Radio Free America, broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC, Los Altos Hills.
Radio Free America, 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 America.
Here we go. Like I said before, there are times when things don't lay the way they're supposed to lay. But regardless, you're supposed to hold your head up high and walk tall. Walk tall.
Once again, I'm going to read that last quote from A Higher Form of Killing, subtitled The Secret Story of Chemical and Biological Warfare, authored by Robert Harris and Jeremy Paxman. This book is published in softcover by Hill and Wang, copyright 1982. And by the way, for people who eventually hear this on tape, this is now March 3rd, 1987. I'm adding this on to Radio Free America number 16. This program is being rebroadcast on sister station KKUP in Cupertino, California. And the original broadcast from April of 1986 has proved quite unnervingly accurate in light of some of the things that have come to light since. Once again, from A Higher Form of Killing by Harris and Paxman. As long ago as 1962, 40 scientists were employed at the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Laboratories on full-time genetics research. Many others, it was said, appreciate the implications of genetics for their own work. The implications were made more specific 7 years later, when a Department of Defense spokesman claimed that genetic engineering could solve one of the major disadvantages of biological warfare, that it is limited to diseases which occur naturally somewhere in the world. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. And the authors go on to add, the possibility that such a super germ may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside. Well, in light of that prediction that within that, in this in 1969, that within the next 5 to 10 years it should be possible to genetically engineer a disease that would be refractory to the human immune system, listen now to the following article. This from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, August 18th, 1986. This is a Washington Post story, datelined Washington and headlined, A New Look Urged at Germ Weapons. Advances in biotechnology have transformed biological weapons from ones that were unimportant and self-defeating into weapons, quote, that may indeed be great weapons, unquote, according to Douglas Fife, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Negotiations Policy. That man's last name is F-E-I-T-H. Fife emphasized that the Defense Department is not proposing that the United States begin making biological weapons. Those weapons were destroyed and research was stopped during the Nixon administration. He said the prime worry now in the Pentagon is that the Russians are developing such weapons. Administration officials have already expressed concern about biological weapons. The significance of Fife's testimony, delivered August 8th to a subcommittee of the House Select Committee on Intelligence and declassified for release yesterday, indicates that some factions within the Reagan administration, particularly in the Pentagon, are considering biological weapons in a new light. Skipping down in the article, the United States renounced biological weapons because they were difficult to control. They could infect either side and were in other ways inferior to nuclear and chemical arms. More important, U.S. possession of them would encourage smaller nations to consider them useful as what critics called, quote, the poor man's nuclear bomb, unquote. Listen very carefully to the next statement. Fife told the committee, quote, the stunning advances over the last 5 to 10 years in the field of biotechnology mean more than new foods, pharmaceuticals, and fertilizers. They mean new and better biological weapons for any country willing to violate the international norm against the possession of such weapons. New technology has exploded the standard ideas about biological weapons that prevailed 10 or more years ago. Reading that last statement again, Fife told the committee, the stunning advances over the last 5 to 10 years in the field of biotechnology mean more than new foods, pharmaceuticals, and fertilizers. They mean new and better biological weapons for any country willing to violate the international norm against the possession of such weapons. New technology has exploded the standard ideas about biological weapons that prevailed 10 or more years ago. Skipping down again in the article, because new biological agents are so simple to make and can be manufactured in hours, claims challenged by some knowledgeable scientists, Fife also said that no treaty could stop them. He said the treaty banning them, the 1972 Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, is both, quote, critically deficient and unfixable, unquote. A review of the treaty is scheduled next month in Geneva. Fife said in a telephone interview, quote, the Department of Defense years ago went along with President Nixon's judgment that BW, Biological weapons under the then current technology were not militarily significant. Given the type of weapon it was, there were better weapons. And it is now clear, using the newest technology, that BW can be highly militarily significant. We have changed our opinion about the military utility of BW. Well, our fear and our contention is that what changed his opinion was AIDS. I certainly hope I'm wrong. I don't think I am. Another very alarming development was carried in the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday morning, August 31st, 1986. This is a story by Steve Sternberg of the Knight Ridder News Service, headlined, "Infighting Reported Among AIDS Experts." Turmoil among AIDS experts at the Federal Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta has led to two firings, caused an exodus of researchers and delayed studies of ways to halt the deadly epidemic. Quote, "I'm surprised at how little is coming out of that lab," said Dr. Cy Cabradilla, C-A-B-R-A-D-I-L-L-A, a former high-level CDC expert who was among the first to clone the AIDS virus. Quote, "They were on to very important things that now seem trivial because it's too late," unquote. So intense is infighting within the AIDS program. And turning to the rest of the article, let me pick up this next sentence. So intense is infighting within the AIDS program, virus research laboratories, that experts have sabotaged each other's experiments and suppressed research to combat the disease, researchers told the Miami Herald. One departing scientist, Dr. V.S. Kalinaraman, ranks among the nation's most prestigious AIDS workers. Few of the lab's original senior scientists remain. The lab program has lost experts who were instrumental in proving that transfusions spread AIDS, that the AIDS virus causes the disease, and that spermicides can help prevent the spread of AIDS. Dr. James Curran, head of the CDC's Massive AIDS Program Office in Atlanta, attributed the loss of his experts to attrition. He said he does not get involved in personal matters. Quote, "Some people have left, others have come," Curran said. "There were a lot of people coming and going from a lot of places in the last 5 years. Among the allegations, suppression of research. Scientists say Curran temporarily has blocked publication of research, including one paper that showed commercially available spermicides kill the AIDS virus within 60 seconds. And on that last subject, skipping down in the article, Vailer, one of the doctors from the CDC, V-O-E-L-L-E-R, Vailer of the Mariposa Foundation, cites the lab spermicide study as an example of Curran's bias. When the AIDS virus was discovered in 1984, Vailer asked Curran to have the CDC lab test whether commercially available spermicides kill the virus. He refused, Vailer said. Later, Vailer persuaded the CDC to perform the study. The ingredient non-oxanol 9, which is contained in spermicides, was found to be, quote, exquisitely effective, unquote, for killing the virus, he said. Again quoting, "It was approved by Don Francis, who was a co-author, and we gave the manuscript to Curran in February. He stalwartly blocked publication until I gave it to members of Congress in June, and he suddenly expressed an interest in it," Vailer said. Quote, "Then he wanted his name on it. I figured people are dying for lack of information, and if the only way to get it out is to put the man's name on it, let's do it," unquote. The study offered a readily available means of protecting against AIDS during sexual intercourse. One wonders why that information about the exquisitely effective, unquote, exquisitely effective degree to which commercially available spermicides, which would be used with an average diaphragm, or I suppose could be used by another person and other forms of sex, why has that information been suppressed in light of other information about condoms? And again, I think the suppression of that information is not only disturbing, but is more than a little suspicious. I'd like to conclude this addendum to Radio Free America number 16 by quoting a small section from an article read in the original broadcast, this from the Annals of Internal Medicine, volume 103, number 5, from November of 1985. The article is called "The International Occurrence of the Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome" by J.B. Brunet, B-R-U-N-E-T, and R.A. Ancel, A-N-C-E-L-L-E. At the conclusion of the article is an interesting statement concerning where AIDS comes from. "Tracing the course of an epidemic has many of the same elements found in a detective story. The difference is that there is no murderer to track except the infectious agent itself. No scientific evidence has yet been given to identify the origin of the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, and the history of epidemics suggests that this mystery may never be solved. Well, I don't know if the mystery will ever be solved, but I'm afraid that the origin of this epidemic is indeed, as Dr. Jordan indicated, in the United States. I hope I'm wrong. I'm afraid that I'm not. And in this case, I think the statement that the difference is there is no murderer to track except the infectious agent itself may be overly optimistic. My fear, again, is that, as Walt Kelly's comic strip character Pogo said, we have met the enemy, and he is us. That concludes this addendum to Radio Free America number 16. This information will be available on the master tape available from DAVCorp. Thanks for listening.